Savitri, Book 6, The Book of Fate, Canto 1, The Word of Fate. This is Part 5. It's on pages 431 through 436. Narad, the messenger of the gods, has finally delivered the message he came to give. Satyavan, Savitri's mate, her chosen husband, has only 1 year left to live. He is fated to die exactly 1 year from the day Savitri and her parents learn of his destiny. The great all-knowing sage and singer of the gods has said, quote, 12 swift-winged months are given to him and her. This day returning, Satyavan must die. Last time we saw that Savitri's mother had asked Narad not to hide their doom. She had become alarmed because he was subtly hinting at coming disaster. And we saw last time that even though she had attained wisdom and tranquility, when she feared for her own child's future, she allowed the lower vital forces to express themselves through her, and she fell to the lot of common man. She opened her doors to grief. And as a common man, beneath his load, grows faint and breathes his pain in ignorant words, she expressed all her dark forebodings. Although the queen was wise, in this moment of fire testing her great soul, she ignorantly accused the world power and the impartial, impersonal One Supreme of injustice and perversity. She accused them of action turned away from what is right. Then she complained of the karma that returns to pay us back for our own cruelties and the sufferings that we have inflicted on others. Finally, she said that although she was strong enough to bear her own punishment, because she knew it was just, she could not bear the sufferings of others. And now, this is her own beloved child, and her child is going to have to face a disastrous fate. So, although knowing it is hard to bear, the fear of the unknown doom, that she doesn't know what will happen, but it's going to happen to her child, the fear of unknown doom is worse. She says it is best to know. And Narad set free the springs of fate. He said, "The truth thou hast claimed, I give to thee the truth." He described Satyavan's great value and his beauty. And then he said that heaven's greatness came, but was too great to stay. And when he said, "This day returning, Satyavan must die," the queen's cry broke forth once more. One of the great truths that Sri Aurobindo and Mother teach is that our attitude, our inner response to what life brings us, comes back to us in what happens to us in our daily life. We have to be vigilant to escape our own selves. It's a constant and endless surrender of all that we think and feel that is negative, and a constant choice to be positive at every second. Here we have a good example of the queen not being able to do this. So we will see in this part of the canto that the queen is human still, and like all of us, her knowledge contains a mixture of wisdom and ignorance. We can see how upset she has become by what she says. She says, "Vain then can be heaven's grace." She cries, "Heaven mocks us with the brilliance of its gifts. For death is the cupbearer of the wine of too brief joy held up to mortal lips for a passionate moment by careless gods." And then she cries, "I reject the grace and the mockery." she tells her daughter, that her heart has stooped to a misleading call. She must ride again through the world and make another choice. She must leave this fated head of Satyavan, because here love's sweetness sleeps in the pale marble hand of death. She even tells Savitri not to argue with her about it. She says, "Plead not thy choice, for death has made it vain." This part of Canto 1 is all dialogue between Savitri and her mother. In it, we can hear the echo of perhaps millions of conversations between parents and children all over the world, down through the ages, in every country. Here, it is apparent of relatively less evolved consciousness speaking to a much more evolved child. It could be the other way around, and everything in between, but it's the same echo. The parent is trying to convince their child that they know better and the child should change what it was planning to do. But here, Savitri has been through the deepest, most moving experience of her life. She knows something her mother has not realized, and she has found what everyone dreams of. She has united with the eternal partner of her own immortal soul, her true mate, her mate of countless lifetimes. This meeting of soul with soul has awakened her soul within her. It is very much prominent in her being. It is with the wisdom of her soul that she speaks. And now she speaks eternal truths, truths that come from the immortal wisdom that all souls have, because our soul is the immortal part of us and is always connected to its supreme origin. Now Savitri tells her mother, "Once my heart chose and chooses not again, the word I have spoken can never be erased. It is written in the record book of God. In the book of love, when they met, we saw that even when she first looked at Satyavan with her very heart knew that he was closer to her than her own heartstrings. Even then, her inner vision, still remembering, knew him from all her past." But she doesn't yet explain these things to her parents. She tells her mother, "My heart has sealed its troth to Satyavan. Its signature, adverse fate cannot efface. Its seal, not fate, nor death, nor time dissolve." She says, "Those who shall part, who have grown one being within." She's telling her mother her great truth, but her mother cannot hear it. She also says, "I am stronger than death and greater than my fate. My love shall outlast the world. Doom falls from me, helpless against my immortality." But the queen is too involved and too upset. All the queen hears in Savitri's words is the voice of a self-chosen doom. And the queen responds with words showing the lesser consciousness of her vital being. And Sri Aurobindo points out to us that the queen, although talking to Savitri, is really answering to her own despair. He says, "To her own despair, answer the mother made." The queen speaks like someone who knows only the movements of outer material life. She says things like, "All passes here. He whom thou lovest now, a stranger came, and into a far strangeness shall depart. He will move to other places and other people. His body that thou lovest is cast away. Our souls are forever turning on the wheel of God, forever married, forever torn apart. we can only cry to an unseized bliss. And when it comes, it's not enough, it fails. The Queen is talking about vital attachment, not real love. She says love dies in our breast even before our lover goes. She speaks of our emotions being high and dying notes of a wild music changed by the passionate moments of a seeking hour. All this is the activity of vital love, a love that wants to get all it can all the time, and a love that even wants to control the object of its love, its own dear beloved. Mother and Sri Aurobindo taught a lot about vital attachment and real love. Real love gives unselfishly, gives all the time. Real love waits patiently. Real love is happy just to love. They teach that love is a great universal force, seeking to express itself in all the instruments that it can find. Sri Aurobindo told us back in Book 1, Canto 2, when first we met Savitri, that love found he could move in her as in his natural home. The Queen loves her daughter, but at this upset moment, she cannot see very clearly. Savitri has ended her speech by saying, "Fate's law may change, but not my spirit's will." In response to this, the Queen advises Savitri that she must not take the wave, the titan, and the giant, whose own fierce will is their only law, and who serve neither truth, nor light, nor God. But they only dash their lives against the eternal law and fall and break by their own violent mass. The titan is the Asura, one of the kinds of demons that Sri Aurobindo described at the beginning of the Book of Fate. When Narad came singing down from paradise, down to Asupati's palace, he sang of how they are ready to go back, to give up their terrible job. Their job, the job that they can only do unless they agree to be converted, which apparently they don't do very often, their job is to oppose, resist, and slow down the progress of the light. When Narad sang of the transformation and the ecstasy to come, the demons wept with joy, foreseeing the end of their long dreadful task and glad release from their self-chosen doom and return into the one from whom they came. Sri Aurobindo has said that these asuras are very clever in carrying out their purpose. They know how to work out results. A disciple once said that the asura gives you power. And Sri Aurobindo answered, "The asura gives you nothing. He only uses you for his purpose, and when your use is over, he throws you aside." So it's no wonder that Savitri's mother, who is completely overcome by vital emotion, and believes that Savitri's true love is only a passing vital impulse, is cautioning her daughter not to be like an asura here, not to be blindly willful. She tells Savitri to take the middle path made for thinking man, thinking man who is given calm reason for his guide. In the book of the Traveler of the Worlds, King Ashwapati travels through all the levels of mind. And when he comes to reason, Sri Aurobindo teaches us that our reason is a limiting process and a limited process, and we have to open to higher planes of mind. Mother teaches that we need to live by reason until we are beyond desires and preferences and ego, and we have to be completely beyond being open to any adverse influence. Not only that, in order to get out of reason, we have to be totally surrendered to the divine will. It's a stage of very advanced spiritual development, and in Book 2, once reason is passed, then the traveler of the world starts receiving wonderful higher things from the higher stages of mind in the creation. But here, the queen is taking a reasonable position. She's advising her daughter in reasonable ways to give up her unbending will that will lead to disaster. She advocates a reasonable life. She gives very convincing reasons to choose a safe, peaceful life so that she can raise her spirit slowly into timeless peace. Now Savitri answers directly to the things that her mother is telling her. Now she explains how she feels and why. She says that her will is part of the eternal will. Her strength is not the strength of the Titan. It is the strength of God. She explains that she has found the deep, unchanging soul of love. Her spirit has seen the glory for which it came. Her spirit has seen her eternity, always clasped by Satyavan's eternity, and the deep possibility always to love. She says that compared to this, the riches of 1,000 fortunate years are poverty. There can never be another. There is only Satyavan. If it is only for a year, that year is all her life. But she knows that one year is not all her fate, only to live and love a while and then to die. She knows this because now she knows why her spirit came on earth, and who she is, and who he is that she loves. She has looked from her immortal self, and she has seen the eternal in Satyavan. And then none could answer to her words. Silent they sat, and looked into the eyes of fate. The Book of Fate. The Word of Fate. Narad has explained about Satyavan's doom. He has said, 12 swift months are given to him and her. This day returning, Satyavan must die. A lightning bright and nude this sentence fell, but the queen cried, "Vain then can be heaven's grace. Heaven mocks us with the brilliance of its gifts, for death is a cupbearer of the wine of too brief joy held up to mortal lips for a passionate moment by the careless gods. But I reject thy grace and the mockery. Mounting thy car, go forth, O Savitri, and travel once more through the peopled lands. Alas, in the green gladness of the woods, thy heart has stooped to a misleading call. Choose once again and leave this fated head. Death is the gardener of this wonder tree. Love's sweetness sleeps in his pale marble hand." Advancing in a honeyed line, but closed, a little joy would buy too bitter an end. Plead not thy choice, for death has made it vain. Thy youth and radiance were not born to lie a casket void dropped on a careless soil. A choice less rare may call a happier fate. But Savitri answered from her violent heart. Her voice was calm. Her face was fixed like steel. "Once my heart chose, and chooses not again. The word I have spoken can never be erased. It is written in the record book of God. The truth, once uttered, from the earth's air effaced, by mind forgotten, sounds immortally forever in the memory of time. Once the dice fall, thrown by the hand of fate in an eternal moment of the gods. My heart has sealed its troth to Satyavan. Its signature, adverse fate cannot efface. Its seal, not fate, nor death, nor time dissolve. Those who shall part who have grown one being within. Death's grip can break our bodies, not our souls. If death take him, I too know how to die. Let fate do with me what she will or can. I am stronger than death and greater than my fate. My love shall outlast the world. Doom falls for me, helpless against my immortality. Fate's law may change, but not my spirit's will. An adamant will, she cast her speech like bronze. But in the queen's mind listening, her words rang like the voice of a self-chosen doom, denying every issue of escape. To her own despair answered the mother maid, as one she cried, who, in her heavy heart, labors amid the sobbing of her hopes to wake a note of help from sadder strings. O child, in the magnificence of thy soul, dwelling on the border of a greater world, and dazzled by thy superhuman thoughts, thou lendest eternity to a mortal hope. Here on this mutable and ignorant earth, who is the lover, and who is the friend? All passes here. Nothing remains the same. None is for any on this transient globe. He whom thou lovest now, a stranger came, and into a far strangeness shall depart. His moments part, once done upon life's stage, which for a time was given him from within, to other scenes he moves, and other players, and laughs and weeps mid faces new, unknown. The body thou hast loved is cast away amidst the brute unchanging stuff of worlds to indifferent mighty nature, and becomes crude matter for the joy of others' lives. But for our souls, upon the wheel of God forever turning, they arrive and go, married and sundered in the magic round of the great dancer of the boundless dance. Our emotions are but high and dying notes of his wild music, changed compellingly by the passionate movements of a seeking heart in the inconsistent links of hour with hour. To call down heaven's distant answering song, to cry to an unseized bliss, is all we dare. Once seized, we lose the heavenly music's sense. Too near, the rhythmic cry has fled or failed. All sweetnesses are baffling symbols here. Love dies before the lover in our breast. Our joys are perfumes in a brittle vase. Oh, then what wreck is this upon time's sea to spread life's sails to the hurricane desire and call for pilot the unseeing heart? Oh, child, wilt thou proclaim? Wilt thou then follow against the law that is the eternal will, the autarky of the rash Titan's mood, to whom his own fierce will is the one law in a world where truth is not, nor light, nor God. Only the gods can speak what thou now speakst. Thou who art human, think not like a god. For man, below the god, above the brute, is given calm reason as his guide. He is not driven by an unthinking will, as are the actions of the bird and beast. He is not moved by stark necessity like the senseless motion of inconscient things. The giants and the titans' furious march climbs to usurp the kingdoms of the gods, or skirts the demon magnitudes of hell. In the unreflecting passion of their hearts, they dash their lives against the eternal law and fall and break by their own violent mass. The middle path is made for thinking man, to choose his steps by reason's vigilant light, to choose his path among the many paths is given him, for each his difficult goal, hewn out of infinite possibility. Leave not thy goal to follow a beautiful face. Only when thou hast climbed above thy mind and liv'st in the calm vastness of the One can love be eternal in the eternal bliss and love divine replace the human tie. There is a shrouded law, an austere force. It bids thee strengthen thy undying spirit. It offers its severe benignancies of work and thought and measured grave delight as steps to climb to God's far secret heights. Then is our life a tranquil pilgrimage, each year a mile upon the heavenly way. Each dawn opens into a larger light. Thy acts are thy helpers, all events are signs. Waking and sleep are opportunities given to thee by an immortal power. So canst thou raise thy pure, unvanquished spirit, till spread to heaven in a wide vesper calm, indifferent and gentle as the sky, it greatens slowly into timeless peace. But Savitri replied with steadfast eyes, "My will is part of the eternal will. My fate is what my spirit's strength can make. My fate is what my spirit's strength can bear. My strength is not the Titans, it is God's. I have discovered my glad reality beyond my body in another's being. I have found the deep, unchanging soul of love. Then how shall I desire a lonely good, or slay, aspiring to white vacant peace, the endless hope that made my soul spring forth out of its infinite solitude and sleep? My spirit has glimpsed the glory for which it came. The beating of one vast heart in the flame of things. My eternity clasped by his eternity. And, tireless of the sweet abysms of time, deep possibility always to love. This is first last joy, and to its throb the riches of a thousand fortunate years are poverty. Nothing to me are death and grief, or ordinary lives and happy days. And what to me are common souls of men, or eyes and lips that are not Satyavan's? I have no need to draw back from his arms and the discovered paradise of his love and journey into a still infinity. Only now, for my soul in Satyavan, I treasure the rich occasion of my birth. In sunlight and a dream of emerald ways, I shall walk with him like gods in paradise. If for a year, that year is all my life. And yet I know this is not all my fate, only to live and love a while and die. For I know now why my spirit came on earth, and who I am, and who he is I love. I have looked at him from my immortal self. I have seen God smile at me in Satyavan. I have seen the Eternal in a human face. Then none could answer to her words. Silent, they sat and looked into the eyes of fate.